We have a quick question from Sarah. Do you think God is perplexed over the fact that, quote, no one chooses God, unquote, that in a way it wonders him, but because he is God, he handles it in a righteous and appropriate way?
So the image that's brought to my mind is if I was like to cast myself back to high school and I would have a crush on a young lady, and I never had that high self-esteem except when I did. And every now and then I would have like just a great day. Everybody would be laughing at my jokes. My hair would be on point. The cologne that I had put way too much of on had finally started to fade a little bit, and I had this great musk going on. And I would just look at myself in the mirror and go like, how could she not think I was awesome? How could she not be in love with me? Because I'm so incredible. And this image, it helps me contextualize this, because God so deserves our love, right? God so deserves our admiration and our appreciation and our respect, and he doesn't get it so often. And it, helping contrast it for me with the delusions so often of thinking I do deserve this fame and honor and adoration when I didn't before, it's helpful for me.
Mm-hmm. I think that is a really good question. I like thinking about that. My off the top of my head answer is it, so let's go to your I'm dressed so nice. Did you use the word musk?
Yeah. Did you ever have like the situation like in high school? Now I'm sure I was completely wrong, but okay, like let's say maybe it wasn't when I woke up, but like it was like, you know, midway through third or fourth period, and my cologne had just like kind of gone in, you know, I'd put on way too much cologne obviously, and like maybe I'd had like a little bit of gym class, and so in my mind I'm like, there's a perfect scent of musky man and cologne, and my hair is perfect, and I don't know, is that, yeah, I did say musk.
Yeah, I just want to make sure. I need to file that away for later questioning. So imagine if you knew this girl's backstory in the illustration you brought up, and you knew everything that happened to her, because we all have these backstories that that basically they don't control us today, but they push us in certain mm-hmm. directions. And until we are aware of all those things, including the blind spots, we just keep getting pushed and pushed and pushed. But if you knew all that, you would know exactly why she was rejecting you.
That's good.
You know, and I think that this is the challenge with thinking about God. I, without even thinking about it, give God my limitations constantly. And then the irony is I read the Bible and be like, that's so amazing. And then I look at my own life and I'm like, but God's limited with my stupidity today. Mm. And I was like, no, yeah, their stupidity then, you know. So that's a really good question. But I think that's, at least the way I conceptualize it, that's what he knows, all of our backstory. He knows
that's really good.
Why we're fighting against him. Now, that doesn't mean he's controlling it. He's simply saying he works with us to the degree we let him.
That's really good. As you've like been in relationship with someone longer, whether it's a marriage or a friendship or discipleship relationship, you hear more stories, you begin to hear more of their heart. And whereas something before you've been like, why the heck is Jason that way, or why does my wife do the thing that she does? And then you hear the story and it just all clicks. You're like, oh, that's exactly why. God is seeing the whole picture, and he's not just seeing your piece of it, but he's seeing the whole piece of it. That's a really good perspective for me. I appreciate that. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you, Sarah. That's awesome.
Hello, my name is Connor.
And I'm Jason.
And you're listening to the Amazed and Perplexed podcast.
Hey, what's up, guys? My name is Easton Davis, and I am 21 years old. And I chose the parable of the talents, which, incidentally, from the version that I'm reading is called the parable of the bags of gold, which is just super funny. It will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his wealth to them. To one he gave 5 bags of gold, to another 2 bags, and to another 1 bag, each according to his ability. Then he went on his journey. The man who had received 5 bags of gold went at once and put his money to work and gained 5 bags more. So also the one with 2 bags of gold gained 2 more. But the man who had received 1 bag went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. For a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with him. The man who had received 5 bags of gold brought the other 5, and he said, Master, you entrusted me with 5 bags of gold. See, I have gained 5 more. And his master replied, Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things, so I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. The man with 2 bags of gold also came. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 2 bags of gold. See, I have gained 2 more. His master replied, Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things, and so I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. Then the man who had received one bag of gold came. Master, he said, I knew that you were a hard man, harvesting where you had not sown, and gathering where you had not scattered seed. So I was afraid, and went out and hid your gold in the ground. See, here is what it belongs to you. His master replied, you wicked and lazy servant. So you knew that I harvest where I have not sown, and gather where I have not scattered seed? Well, then you should have my money on deposit with the banker, so that when I returned, I will have received it back with interest. So take the bag of gold from him and give it to the one who has 10 bags, for whoever will be given more, and they will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what they have will be taken from them. And throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth.
The parable of the talents, Jason, or the parable of the bags of gold? I wonder, like, do they have the little dollar signs on the side of them? I was really disappointed when I became an adult that when they handed you cash at the bank, they gave it to you in envelopes and not, like, you know, little bags.
It's like, is it Scrooge? Is that your picture, like the dollar signs on the side?
So, Jason, what amazes you about this parable?
What amazes me about this passage is just the dynamic. Again, if I think God is the master and he's handing out this undeserved giftedness and he trusts the people. That amazes me that God trusted the people in the Bible. And I think that's why if you really read the narratives in the Bible, Old and New Testament, you'll see, sometimes you have to read between the lines, and other times it's just so plain that these people are deeply flawed people, and yet he trusts them. And that is staggering to me. I mean, I have a hard time trusting someone once I feel they betrayed me, even in slight ways. I mean, it is work for me. And in church settings, and I don't know if this matches your experience, but in church settings, because you assume everybody loves you and you're working hard off that premise, that when there's a slight betrayal, it feels even bigger.
Yes.
You know? And so that's hard work for me. But Jesus knows these people have messed it up, are messing it up, and will mess it up, and he trusts them to do it. And I guess, you know, and in this case, you're like, okay, 2/3 paid off. Mm-hmm. You know, looking at it from the pure details of the parable, but you missed 1/3. Did you make the right choice here? You know, master kind of thing. And so, but at the crux of it is that deep abiding trust in, I don't even know if it's people, but it's in himself, in people. Sure. Now I'm extrapolating from the parable, but that's what really jumps out at me.
No, that's a point that I wouldn't have thought about. Cause I want to talk about the trust of the men towards the master. And I think you drawing on this angle is it's really helpful for me to see from the other side that this is a story of mutual trust. It's not if we were to tell a story about a master and a servant, it's not the same sort of relationship, the same sort of dynamic that we would assume it would be. And man, yeah, that there is mutual trust there. It's pretty incredible. I would have never picked up on that if you hadn't said it.
Yeah, so what amazes you?
Sure, I think what amazes me, I mean, there's so many things that amazes me about this passage. And I don't know if what I'm about to say is completely incorrect, but here's the message that I received about this passage growing up. It's that, you know, you've received the gospel, right? And so you've been given this gift, and God has given you these abilities, this message to spread. And if you don't gain X number of converts, if you don't, you know, be a Jesus person for an X amount of days, if you haven't lived a profitable life, if you haven't produced enough, then you're failing, right? And so if you aren't going out there, and if you're not winning souls or whatever the verbiage would be, then you're failing. And it's something I always kind of avoided because, like, I didn't like the way it felt. And I do think we need to be out there spreading the message of Jesus. I do think we need to tell people about Jesus because why wouldn't we want to? Because the message is so fantastic. But here's in my study over the past week or so and over my prayer and just, man, something that God has shown me is I think this story is much less about production than I originally thought it was. The third man, I don't think his failure was that he didn't produce an extra bag of gold. I think his failure was that he didn't trust who God was. The first thing he says about this master is that, master, I know you're a hard man. I know you're tough. I know that you have basically, if you get down into the Greek, basically saying, like, I know that you're a hard, sometimes unfair man to work with. And so I am so afraid of you that I was unable unable to move, unable to take the risk to go forward. And the master quickly gets rid of part of that excuse by saying, well, then you could have just put it in the bank to, you know, get interest. But what I think what Jesus is trying to draw out of this parable is the failure of the man was not that he didn't produce an extra bag of gold. The failure of the man was that he had an inaccurate depiction of the master. He thought the master was hard. He thought the master was cruel. He thought the master was about production. He thought the master was about maintaining where you are, maintaining what you have. And that's an incorrect picture of the master. And I think for me, this is so mind-blowing and man, amazing, because if we have a God that's not about maintaining, that means we have a God that's about growth. It doesn't mean we have a God about growth and, well, you have to outpace this quarter by 12.4% or otherwise you're in trouble. We have a God that's about continually growing in the trust, continually growing in giving these things over to him. And this message, I'm still processing like so much of what we talk about on the podcast, but this message is so incredible to me because it goes against a lot of what maybe some of my preconceived notions of the passage.
I'll tell you, if somebody was, you know, manuscripting everything you say, you know, making a transcript of this.
Mm-hmm. I feel so bad for them.
You know, but if they were doing it, what you were just saying, I feel like, man, you just described the way I perceived church growing up. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't have even talked about my relationship with God because we didn't talk that way. We talked about your relationship with church and are you keeping the rules fundamentally was the litmus question at all time. But this dynamic, now God does call us to fear the Lord, and that's right, but what mm-hmm. that means is I respect you, I understand you are way big and I am way tiny, like mm-hmm. like I have nothing to
righteous.
Offer you,
and
you are totally righteous and I am totally sinful, and that's seeing reality. When I hear fear the Lord, I'm like, you see reality, because when people get, oh, I'm speaking with an angel, we're not even talking about God, a messenger, they have to be told repetitively, don't be afraid, because the realization of it, the awareness of it, the reality of it causes them to cower immediately. So they have to be reassured. No, 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 I'm not going to kill you here, because the visual is I'm going to kill you,
yes.
You know? And so when I fear God, I'm living in reality. We hear later in 1 John that perfect love drives out fear. And this is the nature of the relationship. You fear God, meaning you're God and I'm not. I need a mediator. I need a savior. I need a reconciler. So I have Jesus. But now that I'm in you, God, I have nothing to fear. And that would correlate with 2 Timothy, where he says, God didn't give you a spirit of timidity. Mm-hmm. You know? And this is the thing that I think we're very fractured in our intake of the Word of God, where we have all these contradictions in our own self that I'm like, I am more than a conqueror, but I need to be really afraid of doing this wrong. And you can't have both of those in your, you can have both those in your mind, but you can't have both of those in your mind and be healthy.
And flourish, yes.
Exactly. And you lose the sense of wonder, you lose the sense of adventure. We give into comparing ourselves, mm-hmm. and we talked about that some last time. It just leads to all kinds of pain. And so your articulation there, I think it's dead on, is that idea, the crux of the matter here is not the one that made more, and it's not even a comparison between one and two.
Yeah.
Because then we can go into endless cycles. Well, why do you give this guy this and this guy less? Why not give him the same amount?
Sure.
Don't know, and there may be some good things to glean from that, mm-hmm. but the point is, these two guys trusted, like the second guy didn't say, well, if I'm only getting less than half, then what's the point? You know what I mean? And Jesus was, or the master was equally pleased with both those guys.
So I think it's such an important to draw a little bit out. So Jesus, so the master, he gives these talents, he gives these bags of gold, if you will, and he gives varying degrees, right? He gives 5 to 1, 2 to the other, and 1 to the other. And I think there's part of us that goes, well, that's kind of unfair. That's not right. But what I love about this is when we talked last week, we talked about how often comparison can steal joy, that when we compare the blessings or the gifts or the situation that somebody else is in, it can rob us of joy like that. But comparison for God doesn't rob his joy. So when he looks at the first man and he, you know, has suddenly 10 talents worth of gold, he has 10 bags of gold where he had 5 before, that's 6 more than the second man, he is not any less joyful for the second man and his faithfulness. And I think this says something so profound about God. One, he knows this intimately, right? He knows that for the first man, he needs like no more than 5 bags of gold, and he needs no less than that. That's what he needs to flourish. But he also knows for the second man, if I gave him 5 just like the first man, it might ruin him. It might be terrible for him. And he knows them so intimately and so perfectly that there's no comparison of like, well, man number two, you know, I mean, I did give more to man number one, but look how much more he's produced. There's the same joy. And I think about this in just comparison to us and how quickly our joy can be stolen away from us by comparison. And for God, when we fully live out our calling as image bearers, as followers of Jesus, that, man, that is what he delights in. That's what he's calling us to, right? He's calling us to this perfected image, to this higher version of ourselves that is reflected, reflected in that where we reflect Jesus. And I think this is so profound that this is what brings so much joy and life to God, is that when we live out our full purpose and our full calling. And man, I could go for days about that.
So what you said just hit me in regards to, man, there's a couple things, time. First of all, that idea of fine tuning, that idea of a unique response to each individual. And we see this throughout the Gospels in Jesus's actual interactions with people, how he doesn't heal blind people the same. He doesn't heal lame people the same. He's always doing it slightly different.
Yes.
And when you dig into what little you know, you're like, I bet you this is why, for the sake of that person. Why is he touching the leper but not touching the woman caught in adultery? Mm-hmm. You know, and it's a fascinating dynamic. And there are other people he heals, and they're not even in the same town, yes. You know? And so he fine-tunes his response. And what if the person, think about the anxiety of the person that received one talent. And I want to say, we don't know exactly how much one talent, the dynamic is 20 years of a day laborer's wage, which in our money now, if that's about $15 an hour, so for 20 years, you're approximately talking $600,000, $500,000.
I think the technical term is boatload.
Boatload of money. So this is not a small amount of money. He is so anxious, he buries it, which was a conscientious decision based purely in fear. What if he'd been given 5 times that amount? Oh, this guy would have been in the hospital.
It'd been cruel. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it would just been cruel for God to give him that. So that's mind-blowing. The other thing is this. If you give me $1,000, I'm blown away. I'll remember it the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. But if I am a trillionaire and you give me $1,000, I'll be like, that is so cute.
Yeah.
That is so cute. I mean, I remember people saying, I don't know who it was, you know, Bill Gates, whoever, but it's not worth their time to bend down and grab a $100 bill.
Yes.
Because the energy expended in that, and that's ludicrous, but we get the point. And so when we're talking to God, he's not like, I'm really trying to I only have 8 talents here, so I got to divvy this. He has billions of talents. He owns the cattle on 1,000 hills, which is a picture of having all resources. And this is, I don't think I realize how deeply this affects me. Back to that idea, I limit God with my imagination about his resources.
Yes. And I think the image that we get, right, of when we don't limit God, right? When we trust in him and we take a step out in faith, you know, the first two men, you see the sort of blessings and the sort of life that comes from that. And then we see the kind of death that comes from the mistrust and the fear and the hiding from God. And man, we'll maybe talk a little bit more about it when we get to perplex, but I think that's such a big thing, that the damage of the angry God in the sky, the sort of damage that can do to individuals, to societies, to religions. And I think that's a big point of what he's getting across here, of Israel's perception of Yahweh. But, oh man, it's good. So let's hear now from Easton what amazes him about this passage.
I think what amazes me about this parable is the fact that it portrays a dichotomy of equality. It's an equality, a dichotomy of justice, but also of equality. And I think that's really important, because I think we think about the gospel as one that creates, everyone's created equal in the eyes of God. Everyone is seen, if you're a Christian, God sees you the same. You have the same chances to do everything. And I think that's true. But also, it's interesting here that he says the words, he gave them the bags of gold, each according to his ability. And I think that follows true to like what is entrusted with us. Like if the kingdom is entrusted to us, we also have different abilities. We have different talents. And so some of us are entrusted to spread the gospel in a well way, like in a good way, like the Amazing Perplexed podcast. And some are not. Like I see myself as one that's not suited to really do that well in a setting like this. And I think that's cool that like he was able to see that. I mean, everyone's not created equal in Jesus's eyes. And it's crazy that there's that like knowledge and wherewithal this to say that. But on the other hand, it's also amazing that like each person had the same ability to double what it was. And so the equality comes through then in the sense that each has a chance to do with what they have. And I think that's really, really amazing that he was able to, in such few words, just describe this dichotomy of just like inequality that just exists within humanity, but also equality in the future. And the inequality exists in what we are born with, but tomorrow's always a new day, and there's always an equal opportunity to take it and do what we're supposed to do with it.
I love what Easton had to say there, and it's kind of going along with some of the things we talked about a little bit before. One thing that I want to draw on a little bit, you talked about the equality or the sameness. There's differences, and yet there's sameness, right? We're viewed like we all have different abilities, different gifts, different stations in life, and yet God still views us. He loves us the same way, and that, man, that's so beautiful and amazing that God is so complex that he can handle that. And he talked about how maybe podcasting isn't his medium for love or even spreading the gospel. Well, Easton Davis, for those who don't know, I was a youth intern when Easton Davis was in high school in his youth group. And man, I used to love the way that Easton, as like a 17, 18-year-old, would engage with like the sixth graders, the seventh graders of the group. We would play these games like called Three Peg. And basically it's like a foot sort of dodgeball where you just try to nail each other as hard as possible. And we'd play it at every youth event. And I was always amazed at Easton's spirit and when a seventh grader wanted to play with us. And when a seventh or sixth grader wanted to play with us, it kind of ruined the flow of the game because they weren't dexterous enough to really handle it. But yet, even when some of the other older kids were frustrated, Easton was always loving and kind and wanted to engage the younger kids. And so, man, that's one of those areas where I think, and I wouldn't discount Easton's ability to talk about the gospel and talk about the message, but I think, man, that's another way that Easton was like a absolute blessing and was being the gospel.
I think that is so good. I so appreciate his perspective because there's so much, and this is the point of what we're doing. I missed it. Like, oh, mm-hmm. I'm so glad you said that. I hadn't thought about it before. It comes down to what pleases God, and it goes back to the very thing you're saying about productivity. You know, so when I think about applying the word equality, God is not looking for equal production. And that's what we think. I say, so yeah. You get up and you preach. And I mean, because that's obviously the height of spirituality, right?
Yes.
Because that's what Jesus had everybody doing preaching. It's such a funny thing how we've twisted that. But anyway, but you preach, and I mean, you hit, I don't know how we quantify it, but you are like 10 stars.
Mm-hmm.
And I preach, and 100 people come up to you. Oh, this is not make-believe. I've had this experience. I'm at a thing and I speak, and two people come up and say, hey, that was good. And one's like, I think you misquoted this, you know. And then the next guy speaks and like 50 people come up to him. And they're all physically, they're patting him on his back and trying to make sure, you remember me? I was at this other thing, you know, kind mm-hmm. of thing. And I'm like, oh, that guy produced and I didn't. And that is not God's lens. God doesn't evaluate that. What's interesting in this parable that I've never noticed is he doesn't tell the guy with two. He doesn't have different words for him. He has the same words as mm-hmm. the guy that produced 10 and the guy that produced, what would the two guy produce? 5. It's the idea, or two more, I guess. But it's the idea that he says, this goes back to what we're saying. Did you trust me? And act on like a person that trusted me. Trust is not simply saying, hey, yeah, I believe in you. Trust is, I believe you will do what you said you'll do, and I'm watching for you to do it, you know? And so that dynamic, but God is not asking the one to produce anything but interest. Interest is not going to double your what you had.
Yes.
You know what I mean? His point isn't even about the interest. His point is, do you understand? You have, now we're taking it to God, you have judged God incorrectly. And this is, we need to let this bear. If I view God as somebody to constantly fear, it's not just I'm getting it wrong.
Yeah.
There is judgment from God for me to look at the loving God in the Bible and say, no, no, really, you're that all-watching eye that's just watching me make a mistake. And that's really convicting me right now. It's not just, hey, bummer, you don't have this view of a loving God. He says he's loving. So regardless of why we have a different perspective, we need to understand when we say, no, 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 I know the truth about you, God, you're scary. Mm-hmm. And it's all about my production and it's all on my shoulders. That is not just a shame. That is very detrimental to your connection, because he goes on, and we'll get into this with perplexing for me, but it's like, I'm even taking away what you had.
Yes. And he, at the end, you know, he ends it with the famous, and I'll, you know, cast you into the darkness, will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And I think, and we kind of flow into perplexing here. I think this gets to what happens when we reject Jesus, or when anybody, you know, turns away or doesn't choose Jesus when they have the opportunity to. Jesus will use a lot of different kind of imagery when we'll talk about people who choose not to follow him, or choose things that aren't of God, or choose not to be with God. And the most common one that, at least in America, we like to draw on is fire. And one thing I think and the image that Jesus wants to draw on here is darkness. And I think we talk a lot about, you know, God punishing, right? We talk a lot about God, you know, bringing down wrath or whatever the thing is. And I think, man, this is such a great example of natural consequences. So what's the natural consequence of me turning away from the God of life and the God of light? It's darkness, right? If God is the source of life, if God is the source of all things good, if I reject him, if I keep choosing against him, what is the natural consequence of that? I'm not going to live life. I'm going to live life in darkness. I'm going to live life in fear and anger and the things that aren't of him. And so I think, you know, a lot of people get and have a lot of consternation over this passage and plenty of other passages, and I'm sure we'll get to them at some point. But I think this is not a scary passage. It is scary, but it's not scary like I used to think it was. It's scary it's not scary the punishment that God is going to levy on us. It's, for me, it's scary what happens when God allows us to make decisions that go away from him.
Absolutely. I think if we want to put it in terminology, what is it he's wanting to produce? I mean, I feel like we're a bit broken record, but I feel like the Bible is broken record, but we don't listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you can trust me with you. You can trust me with you. Jason, I'm God, and you can trust me with you. It's not about, okay, now that you know the truth, you better behave better.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and it's not throwing out moral behavior. It's just moral behavior. It has to come from a relationship with God. To have moral behavior without a deepening relationship with God means you're trusting in your own self, which is anathema. It's the exact opposite,
yes,
of what God is calling us to. And I think this is the issue. Here's the thing. I always like to think, how do we make this go better for this guy? If this is a real life situation, this guy that only got one, what if he came and he's watching what's happened and he says, God, Master, I repent. I had this all wrong. I see now you're generous.
I've seen how you've treated these other two. I was wrong to think that you weren't this man.
I gave in to my fear. I screwed it up. I believe with all my heart the Master would say, all right, now we're getting somewhere. Now I'm going to give you this again, and I want you to just relax and let me lead you in how to accomplish this. And I think that's the key.
So I just want to say a quick question. I think even if, and we recognize this is a parable, this is a story, but even with the man who has won, if he had gone and he had tried to make something of it and failed and came back with less, but had tried and came back with an open and honest hand and God, I failed. I didn't succeed in this. And I think the answer very well could be, God, well, you trusted me. You trusted me. You lived your life for me. Where did you fail? You have less money? I have plenty of money.
Right.
I have plenty of money. So, yeah, I don't know.
No, that's really good and really helpful. Over the last, I don't know how long this has gone on, but I remember hearing this in my 20s and 30s that we need to give God our absolute best. And that translated to we have to do everything with excellence, which then translated to this kind of perfectionism, but you can't be perfect in all of your life. So it hones down to, well, we can be perfect for an hour. We can do this everything right. You know what I mean? Now, I'm not suggesting this started in my 20s and 30s. I just began to conceptualize it as I moved into more leadership. I'm like, oh, the goal here is to make sure we don't do anything wrong. We get it perfect for this hour. And I think that is a huge reason why people separate their spiritual life from the rest of their life, because the message is we've got to do it perfect. And this hour is the only time we can really do that perfect.
And here's the thing. If I do it perfectly, maybe I was given 2 talents. But if I do it perfectly, I'm going to compare myself to the person that was given 5. And if they have 10 talents, I'm going to feel like even if I got the 4, I'm going to feel like I failed. I'm going to feel like, have you ever been in a situation where you've been at like a minister's or a preacher's or a pastor's conference and you had like, you had the big guy who's got the, you know, 10,000 member church. And there was this sense when you talk to people like, oh man, if I could have the resources that he has, or if I could have the success that he has, inevitably, I mean, this is a big thing in all cultures and all work settings. But I think people would be shocked to know how prevalent this is in churches. Man, if we could just be like the church, if we had the resources, you know, that the other church had, if I had the speaking ability, or if I could just get things right, I would have what they had. And I
find it ironic because I've had people say, you know, when I've even asked, you know, what about this pursuit of excellence? Like, where do you see that? They're like, well, look at the Old Testament and how he had the temple just so, and these kind of things. And then it hits me. I'm like, you don't have that correlation in the New Testament. You don't have a book of the Bible or a chapter in the Bible or even really constructed verses in the Bible that say, here's exactly how you're supposed to put an hour together. Matter of fact, you never hear them say, and they came together for that 1 hour.
Mm-hmm. Here's exactly how you do communion. Here's when and how long. And
yeah. Right. We are phone call affecting, if that speaks to you. You know, one side of a conversation from the letters and then trying to form structure out of that. And I'm not anti-structure. My point is that we've elevated things that Jesus specifically doesn't elevate, that God doesn't elevate, that he did elevate in the Old Covenant. Mm-hmm. He did elevate, here's exactly what you have to do with every little thing and do this. And the whole point, you know, Galatians says the whole law was a tutor to lead you to Jesus because you can't do it perfect. And then we turn around and say, but we can do this hour perfect. Mm-hmm. And it creates this split in us, this duality.
Oh, no, I think there's comfort there knowing, right? Because for us, if we're trying to achieve our perfect and our perfect is somebody else's perfect, there's comfort in knowing that almost certainly the person who you perceive as having been given more gifts, blessings, talents, whatever it may be, that they're also struggling. There's also somebody out there who they go, if I could just get to their level, or if I could just achieve what they've achieved, if I could just get to what I perceive as perfect. And I think if it's always something that we're like, well, I mean, I know that's the case, but it would sure be nice if I was at that level. If I had that level of perfection, and sure, like I'm sure it would be, but it's not going to bring fulfillment. It's not going to bring satisfaction in Jesus,
right? And that, as you pointed out, that's the opposite of what Jesus is telling here. Really, the whole of the New Testament, specifically in this parable, he's saying, "Do you understand?" The financial productivity is not the point.
Yeah.
Because if it was, then he would say to the one that got 5, he's like, oh, you're so much better than the one that got 2. That's not the thing at issue. So what perplexes you about this?
So what's perplexing is also comforting. So oftentimes, man, I will get so, you know, as I've gotten older, I've read more and more of church history and theology outside of the bounds that I grew up in, and it's such a blessing. And you know, I'll have these thoughts and go, oh man, why is nobody thinking this? And then I'll go, oh, people have been thinking this for thousands of years, but they just weren't in my circle. And so I'd encourage you, man, you know, get outside of your circle in terms of church history and that sort of thing. But there is this idea when I worked with kids and with plenty of adults and in popular culture that God is this bearded man sitting on a throne, angry with a, you know, basically all he does is just be angry at what we do, be angry at our thoughts, be angry at our actions. And that's the only thing that he really cares about. That's the only thing he really does. He's just as your angry dad who is waiting for you to mess up so that he can come down hard on you. It's perplexing and comforting that this is not new, that this has been a struggle this has been a struggle since the beginning, right? I mean, you can go back to the garden, right? And the serpent's lie of basically the serpent trying to convince Eve that God was hiding something from her, that God was holding out on her, that God wasn't who he said he was, that he wasn't the author of life and the giver of love and grace and peace. So it's perplexing, but it's also comforting. This isn't a new battle we face. So whenever I was faced with a situation where I had a teenager that just assumed that, oh, God is the God who I see in popular culture. He's the angry God waiting for me to mess up. It's so frustrating to have to try to break those barriers down and get people to see. So yeah, I don't even have a place to go with that, but it is what it is.
I think that really, that's one of the things I'm taking away from this discussion is that dynamic of, it's, I don't know if it's ever hit me exactly like this, but when God says, I am love, and I say, okay, that's what it says. But in my mind, I'm going to say, you're mean. Mm. In my mind, I'm going to say, you're just waiting to pounce. In my mind, you just can't wait to rake me over the coals. That's sin. That's, now it may not be intentional sin, because a lot of times we hold on to things we're not questioning, and we need to be, wait a minute, why do I think this way? Why do I feel this way? But that's really convicting to me, is that, now again, even with that, God doesn't want me to get it all perfect in my thinking. He wants me to be humble in front of him. Mm-hmm. And when I realize something, my attitude towards the sin is, oh, I see it. Even if it's habitual sin, even if I know I'm going to commit that same sin the rest of my life, which I don't believe it works that way or it has to work that way. Mm-hmm. But even if I extrapolate and I'm like, man, I really struggle with this area of doing, thinking, saying, the attitude towards it, God, I know you love me. I know it's forgiven. I don't want to do this again. I believe you have the power to get me through. That is so much different to say, oh, I know I'm one script away from you crushing me.
Yeah.
That's just not what's presented in the Bible. The people that God crushes in the Bible are people that have refused him in a way that he knows they won't turn back. And I think that is one of those things that I think, even with the Pharisees, Jesus is, I mean, and they've been very oppressive. They're going to kill him. And he's still saying, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they do. And so that means, in my understanding, that means that God still sees, hey, this might go this way,
yeah,
with them. And so I think we throw ourselves in the, hey, if you think the wrong thing, then you're going to be, they're going to rain down, you know, fire like Sodom and Gomorrah on you, or oh, you're going to get struck by lightning, this kind of
phenomenon.
Phenomena. And it's like, that's not biblical. Now, so then I immediately jumped to Ananias and Sapphira, a totally different discussion. But it is the idea. We have to really consider the context here. What is happening there? You know, so that this is my own mind fighting against myself. But I think that's really important for me to say.
So I think something that plays into this quite heavily is how you were raised and how you view authority and how you view parents. And so this is just a fascinating subject for me, especially my daughter is 3 months away from supposed to being born, under 3 months actually, which is both exhilarating and terrifying. And one thing I spend a lot of time thinking and pondering is for the first 5-6 years of this little girl's life, she is going to implicitly trust me and her mother, and we're going to be the picture of what authority looks like and what truth looks like. And I have seen so many people that they had either abusive parents or they had parents that were just broken in really unhealthy ways and caused lots of damage. And these people then transplanted the view of their earthly father onto their heavenly father. And so there's something I'm constantly pondering is how is my fathering, how am I going to best try to reflect my heavenly father in how I father my little girl? And man, it's something I just want to be so cognizant of, because man, we can do so much good and we can do so much damage. Cause like, I look at like my wife, she has a fantastic father who has just been a faithful man of God for her entire life. And for her, she gets to look at him and go, oh man, how much greater is my heavenly father? And my thought process, my goal is, okay, I know there are things that my children are going to have to go back and to deconstruct of things that I teach them or things that they implicitly learn from me, but how do I best set them up to see God in this truly beautiful way, in this generous and loving and kind way?
I think that is such a a tremendously powerful lens to look through. And I'm grateful that people shared that with me earlier on of the very thing you're talking about. And with all my sinfulness, it has been saving grace. You know, my kids are now, you know, graduate from high school, 18 and 21, you know, in college. And I look at the nature of our relationship and I'm like, man, I know I have so many flaws. But because I had that lens, not just what makes me comfortable or don't embarrass me or, you know, but man, I would give up on it and then I'd reengage and I give up and reengage. But that has really been my saving grace. In terms of just thinking, man, I really want to go the extra mile to present Christ to them in the way I act towards them and the way I respond to things I don't like, those kind of things. So I just think, man, good for you early on to have that in your mind.
Yeah, get back to me in seven months when she's...
when you have no sleep, and I'm like, tell me more about this girl.
I'm just... Well, let's hear now from Easton what perplexes him.
I think what perplexes me about the lesson is just the lesson. Like, it makes... Like, the ending is so weird to me. It's just like, taking the guy who had won, who had, like, was super careful with his master's money, like, thought it out and was like, I'm not going to try to lose this. I'm not going to gamble it and, like, try to lose it. Jesus was like, nah, get out of here. Like, throw him out into the darkness where there'll be, like, weeping and gnashing of teeth. For whoever has been given more, they will have an abundance, and whoever does not have, even what they have will be taken from them. That's so contrary to the upside down gospel that is portrayed. Like, in Jesus' gospel, in Jesus' world, he ushers in a new kingdom that has the poor is in the front, and the one who has the least has the most. And that's just so different than, like, what he says here at the end. And I think that confuses me because, I mean, obviously, like, the complexity of Jesus is, like, unmatched and we can't understand it, but, like, it seems so driven home that that's the case. But in this parable, it's not. It's the one who gambles, and the one who is, like, has the most is, like, the one that's celebrated. And that really doesn't make sense to me. But I think if you think about, like, where it falls, and Jesus has now turned his head and his brain towards the cross, and he knows his time is coming, and he knows that, like, his gospel needs to be spread, his story needs to be spread, it makes sense. But it just seems, it's perplexing that it's just so contrary to what is throughout the entire book of Matthew and even just all the gospel story in general.
I really appreciate that, Easton. I'm glad you brought that up. I think it is perplexing from my point of view on just the extreme reaction. That's how I would frame it, is that, okay, so he didn't make any money and this kind of thing, you know. As we process today this dynamic, and I feel like, man, God's really teaching me right now about this idea that it was never about the money, it was about the trust. And then going back to what we talked about earlier about God fine-tuning every experience. Now, this is an extrapolation, so I mean, it's up mm-hmm. to, it's open to interpretation, but if God knows everything, that means everything, then he knows what this man, again, this man was made up. It's a parable. It's not a real experience, but he would know everything this man will ever do from start to finish in his life. And he will know whether that man, in this moment, he would know whether that man is going to grow from this or he's going to just perpetually reject it. Mm. You know, now when you take it into the parable, so this is a visual, and how does it apply to us? I think one of the reasons why, and it's still, I mean, there's still a gap. I'm like, I don't know exactly why, but this is what I'm thinking. One of the reasons why Jesus tells the story in this way is he is very much elevating the dynamic of trusting him and very much maximizing not trusting him. Do you see the ultimate consequence? Mm-hmm. So since it's a parable and he's not telling a real story or not creating doctrine, he's saying the perception is the people that trust him, they will go on. Like in Luke's version, he says, you now have 10. I'm going to give you 10 cities. Like, you talk about extreme. Mm-hmm. It's like you handled some gold and now I'm going to put you in charge of all these economies, you know?
Yeah. And I think like I said, these are parables, these are stories. And so we're not creating doctrine from them. But when they talk about talents, they're talking about money. in my mind, I think the natural place I go is, well, earthly resources, right? So this means the rich and the powerful. And I think there is part of that, right? But I think the context of what's happening here is Jesus speaking of Israel, right? That's been given so much. It was meant to be a priesthood to all nations, meant to bless and pour out their life for all of these countries. And they rejected and they turned away from that. And they hid their money in a field and they clung to themselves and weren't a blessing to the nations. And so I think one thing that's really hard for us to kind of get our minds around, especially for me, is Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit. Can disadvantage, can a lower station in life sometimes be worth more? Can sometimes a lower station in life, sometimes can tragedy, can that be just as many talents as somebody that was fed with a silver spoon their entire life? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think this is the most challenging part of not just understanding a scripture, but really drawing it into what is this telling me about my life today? Is that this, the way I perceive this parable is this isn't a one-time event. It's like this broad landscape that this keeps cycling through. And maybe at times you'll find yourself as the one that's bearing things, and other times you're like, okay, I'm trusting things. So the cumulative effect, if you keep hiding it, if you keep, and not just hiding it, that's the key, isn't what he did with the money, it's the why. It's the why did this person do it? Because he said, God gave me this, the master gave me this, I'm going to use it to the best of my ability. He said I had the ability, and I'll do it. And the other guy said, no, I don't believe him. I believe he's going to hurt me. I believe I'm going to hide this. It's going to shut me down. And that will eventually lead to separation from him. And I think that's the issue. But when I see this as this one-time event, this guy's doing great work up to this time, and all of a sudden, this is the turning point, it seems mm-hmm. unfair. And I think to see it broader helps me at least to get a sense of it. And then the idea that Jesus fine-tunes it, that yes. this is very specific to this individual.
Yes, I think that's key to what we're talking about here. This isn't, he says he comes back a long time later. This isn't a single moment's notice sort of thing. It's not like this guy just this one time was like, well, you know, I'm not sure if I trust this whole master guy. You know, a long time, we don't know how long time this could be in the story. Could it be 2 weeks? Could it be 10 years? We don't know. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something to draw on that for us, right? Like we are all guilty of sometimes going and burying our treasure. And then the thing that we have to continually do is to draw that back out and to submit it to God and to be faithful, to believe that he is who he says he is, that he's kind, that he's generous, that he's full of life, that he is not our angry daddy getting ready to come and punish us, but he is a good master that wants to rejoice and share in his joy and give us even more than we currently have. And man, when we talk about the comparative view of these three people, the man who thought the master was this angry, bitter, you know, just mean man, versus the master that these others who thought kind, generous, compassionate, sharing in joy. Man, I think about what's more compelling to people. Not what's true, not even what's just true or what's accurate of the Bible or of God or of Jesus. Are we telling people about a God who wants to bless us more, who wants us to share in his joy, to share in his happiness? Thank you for listening to the Amazed and Perplexed podcast. Thank you, Easton Davis. That was a real blessing for us. And like we said before, if you want to be a part of this, you can go to our website, amazedandperplexed.com, to figure out why, to submit a form, to hear back from us on that. We would love to hear your voice. We'd love to be challenged and love to be encouraged by it. At the end of the, you know, fadeaway music, I'm going to have a little bit of a quick drop where I read a passage from The Last Battle. It is a really, man, it's such a great table setting for this parable. If that interests you, stay on. If you don't want to be spoiled, if you have young kids in the car who you haven't read it to yet, I would encourage you to wait, because, man, there's just so much goodness to plumb there. And so, yeah, just encourage you. Grace, peace, and love. So this is a passage towards the end of The Last Battle. Aslan has conquered
evil in the land of Narnia, and now he's bringing his creation, his children, into a new home, into a new country. And there's this scene I'm going to read from in a second that I think just so sets up this dynamic and just puts some really amazing context around it. And so there have been the main characters have been drawn into this stable, drawn through this doorway. And for them, they've entered into this new country. There's these amazing, incredible things that they're witnessing. And then these dwarves who have been for themselves, who have chosen the selfish way over and over and over again, come through the doorway. And this is the passage that we see. Aslan raised his head and shook his mane. Instantly, a glorious feast appeared on the dwarves' knees, pies and pigeons and trifles and ices, and each dwarf had a goblet of good wine in his right hand, but it wasn't much use. They began eating and drinking greedily enough, but it was clear that they couldn't taste it properly. They thought they were eating and drinking only the sort of things you might find in a stable. One said he was trying to eat hay, and another said he had got a bite of an old turnip, and a third said he'd found a raw cabbage leaf. And they raised golden goblets of rich red wine to their lips and said, "Ugh, fancy drinking dirty water out of a trough that a donkey has been at. Never thought we'd come to this." But very soon, every dwarf began suspecting that every other dwarf had found something nicer than he had, and they started grabbing and snatching and went on to quarreling till, in a few minutes, there was a free fight, and all the good food was smeared on their faces and clothes or trodden underfoot. But when at last they sat down to nurse their black eyes and their bleeding noses, they all said, "Well, at any rate, there's no humbug here. We haven't let anyone take us in. The dwarves are for the dwarves." "You see," said Aslan to the children, "they will not let us help them. They have chosen cunning instead of belief. Their prison is only in their minds, yet they are in that prison and are so afraid of being taken in that they cannot be taken out." And what I love about this story that C.S. Lewis portrays here is this gets to what we talked about before about the natural consequences of when we choose to reject God, to reject the things that we know about him. We live in darkness. We see things that God intends to be blessings and amazing things for us, and we see them as curses. We see them as things of folly. And I think that's the core dynamic of what's happening here for these three men in this parable. Two of them, they see an opportunity given to them by the master, and they see it as for what it is, an opportunity to serve, an opportunity to put the master first, to serve the master, to love the master, and for in turn, the master to lavish love upon them. And for the third man, he sees only the fear. He sees only the possible repercussions of failure, and he has an inaccurate picture of what the master is trying to do. And I just love this passage, and hopefully if you've stuck around this long, it blesses you in some sort of way.